I chose this topic for several reasons. One, it's just general interest, I think, for many of us. And 2 years ago, I gave a series here on the theology of Jimmy Carter when he was still a candidate. It was during the 1976 campaign. And the question was raised, what kind of a president would a man who is so explicitly a born-again Christian make? Because we hadn't had in American history a man who was as explicit and direct in his faith and in that particular school of faith in our history since the days of William Jennings Bryan, the most famous bridesmaid in all of American history. He ran for the presidency 3 times, and I guess Henry Clay ran 3 times and didn't make it either, so I guess those two. But since Bryan, we haven't had anybody quite like Jimmy Carter as president, and there were those in 1976 who were worried. And some are still worried. And it's to the question of why Carter seems to be in trouble and what this indicates not only about the administration, but what this indicates about the country itself that I want to talk today. And I'd be very happy to talk as long as any of you would like after the presentation. And questions, and through coffee break, I can survive coffee break because I would like to make this as much a discussion as possible, because I found in this subject, as in so many others, everybody considers themselves an expert in American politics, that's the way it should be. That is very much the way it should be, because as some of you know, I had returned from living in Thailand, where you don't talk politics. We were there for 5 months, and you don't dare talk politics because of it's a dictatorship. And it's fun to come back, and the first thing I noticed when I came back was how we can, draw caricatures and lampoons and everything of our presidents. The big teeth, and it was Nixon, it was the nose, and with Johnson, it was the ears, and all the rest of these things. You don't see those things for Prime Minister Kyaung Suk or the King or anything else, in Thailand, and it's kind of refreshing. Now, I want to start, well, first of all, let me mention a couple of books, because this is the beginning of lectures and discussion series that I want to start on what seems to be happening not only in American politics, but American religion. And I'll be talking tomorrow about what kind of a revival are we in, and because Jimmy Carter is such an explicitly, in quotes, born-again Christian, it's an indication that something is happening in American politics and in American religious life. And the three first books, which I have on the blackboard back here, all address themselves in one way or another to this. The famous book that came out in 1971 by Dean Kelly of the National Council of Churches, Why Conservative Churches Are, I didn't have the whole room for all of it, Are Growing is there, and it's updated, and some people criticized Kelly's statistics, but he's brought out a revised edition, and his new statistics of 1977 indicate that his original thesis was right, and we'll be using this for a discussion book, I think, later on. Another one, John Snook, he's not related to the Snook of Luther Seminary, has a very good book on life, death, religion, some of the new and the more esoteric and exotic religions. Somebody mentioned the other day about the Hare Krishnas handing out lollipops in the airports and so on, all of which indicates something is happening, in American religious life. Put you at your ease today. There is a yoga exercise at 3 o'clock, and this doesn't mean you have to become Buddhist in order to do this. I learned some yoga exercise, and it was very very relaxing, and so on. Although we did have one lecturer who in Thailand who lectured standing on his head, and maybe some people think that's where I'm at anyway all the time. But I would encourage you to attend that, because I think it's fun. With this. In the third book, Richard Quibido is the first book, The World of Evangelicals is the first book out on the born-again history. It's the first history of the born-again movement, which is out. And hopefully, if Augsburg Publishing doesn't go on strike, and they haven't yet, the second book on the born-again movement will be out by this time next year. I hope we can talk about that next year here. At this time. All right, now, I want to make a few generalities to start with Carter. First of all, the most revealing thing, by way of introduction, is that by comparison to other presidents, since we have been able to refine and improve our opinion sampling, is that his popularity has declined more rapidly than any other president in American history. And the last issue of U.S. News and World Report has the statistics. I won't go into all the, you know, the specifics, but I think we all know that his popularity went down more quickly than anyone else's. From the time that Roper and Harris and Gallup and the others were able to develop really very accurate kinds of opinion sampling, and that tells us a great deal. And that's what I want to explore, why this is happening, what this means so far as American politics is concerned, and what it might mean so far as having somebody who has such strong and explicit religious convictions in the White House is concerned. Maybe it's telling us that we shouldn't have somebody with such strong religious convictions, you know, in the White House. Maybe we need wheeler dealers who are more readily able to compromise and, you know, and to be more flexible. That's something I'd like just to throw out for you to think about at the time. Now, the thesis that I want to try to present with Carter is that part of the decline that we find in the popularity polls, and as I say, I'm sure they're accurate, is due to the mistakes that have been made through his administration, but there are also some other very important and influential forces at work in American society, and I've listed five of them here, and I'd be glad to discuss these openly and listen for comments and criticisms and evaluations. Five of these that are at work that indicate the changing nature of the society in which we are living today, and cast light not just so much on what's wrong with, as some people like to call it, you know, the Georgia Mafia, because they've made their mistakes, just as the Texas Mafia did and the Irish Mafia did and all the others did, but that something is happening, some very serious things are happening, both in American politics and American religious life, that I think we should be very much aware of. I think the first major explanation of what's going on is something that started in the 60s and we are seeing growing rather than declining, and that's a growing distrust of basic American institutions, the institutions that have held the country together, on which we had basic agreement for such a long period of time. During the 1950s, many of you here will remember, there wasn't really very much of a serious debate about the nature of the importance of, let's say, the family in American life, or the importance of the school, the public schools, or college education, or the nature of the economy in our life. Now, these things were taken pretty much for granted. And were accepted as such, as there was debate in the churches, but the churches really weren't under attack so much in the 1950s. But in the 1960s, for reasons which some of us know and we don't have time to go into here, a great deal of confidence has been lost in our basic institutions, including the government. And probably the government is the most serious of all, because now every time somebody like a Wayne Hayes shows up, who spent most of his time chasing this non-typist around the office, apparently, we tend to think that all politicians are that way and have two or three courtesans, is the polite word for it, on the payroll, and which is not the case. But you know, we like to believe this because we get our 1040s, and we don't like to see all that money going to people who can't even type. in that, but more serious than Wayne Hayes, obviously, are the events that happened with Watergate, with Vietnam, with some of the revelations that happened with the FBI, with the CIA, and so on. What I'm trying to suggest, you see, is that a society, in order to stay stable, has to have confidence in its basic institutions, and the basic institutions are the church, the economy, the government, the school, the family. And starting in the late 60s, all of these have come under attack. There isn't any of these that isn't seriously being challenged in one way or another. The other day, we had a very good discussion in here, I think it was last Saturday, on the two-career family, and that brought out into a discussion of what was happening to, I mean, the two-career family, what was happening to the family, generally speaking, in American history, and indicated a lack of trust, that the family was the basic and most important institution that we have. So I think that particular trend is very much at work now, distrust in institutions. That we find. I'll give you a perfect, I can't say perfect, but a very good example in medicine. And we see this, I'm from Minnesota, but we see this in many other states. The whole question of Laetrile, for instance, is a very good example of this. because what people are saying in demanding that they be allowed to use Laetril is that they don't trust, you see, the expertise of the doctors. They don't trust the fact that men who have spent all their lives studying cancer know that Laetril is a fraud and that they want to have the freedom, you see, to be able to use it themselves. And that therefore what's happening, and I know Dr. Martell, who's in charge of cancer research at Rochester, I know him very well because I've had three of his children in my classes. And what the problem there, that Dr. Martell says, is that what happens is that people take Laetril first, and then by the time that they find out that it doesn't work, it's too late for any kind of chemotherapy to do anything. But the point I want to raise with Laetril is only that it's another indication that we don't trust the experts. We don't trust the institution of doctors, because no doctor in this country is in favor of, you know, of allowing cancer to spread. And therefore we find ourselves suspicious of any of the experts, because so many times the experts really have let us down. I think that's one important thing, the decline of trust in institutions. And I don't, right now I'm sort of in a gloomy period. I don't see any real hope that in many of these cases this is going to change. I'll be glad to debate that with any of you later on. A second factor is something that with Carter specifically that people forget, and that's that he barely won in 1976, that he barely squeezed through. As I remember it, he got 50.4% of the total electorate, which is not exactly a crashing mandate so far as approval is concerned, because Nixon got, what, 61% in 1972, Johnson got 60.1% or something else like this, you know, enormous landslides. Carter even did poorly in some bellwether precincts, as Roger Mudd likes to call them, you remember, on CPS. He even did poorly in some bellwether precincts which were supposed to be so safe for Democrats that there wasn't any question about this, and he barely squeaked through there. And then what happens, you see, is when some news like Burt Lance comes along, this simply reawakened the doubts and the suspicions that people had in Carter, that he might have been, you know, all right for Georgia, and he might have been a good businessman and all the rest, but he didn't know what in the world was going on up in Washington. So I think that's very important to remember, that he never had a strong mandate from the very beginning in this country, and that enough incidents like Burt Lance, or now this latest one with the doctor, with the drugs, for instance, and so on, have come along to keep alive that doubt in the minds of lots of people. Because Carter came on as an anti-establishment politician, as somebody who was freed and cleared from the sludge, I guess that's the only word you can use, that had been characteristic of Washington through all that period of time. All right. Now, a third factor I think that's very important that I want to use a reading on here is the fact that in this country, especially starting with Vietnam and with Watergate, there has been a strong decline of any sense of unity or purpose in where we're going, what kind of people we are, what kind of society we want for ourselves. Because of the distrust in institutions, for one thing, and distrust of our leaders and so on, there has been simply a collapse of what we would call a consensus. In the 1950s, some of you will remember, Henry Luce, every so often in old Life magazine, used to put out a big issue on America, the national purpose, and everybody was agreed. They'd have important people like Archibald MacLeish or Arthur Larson or Adlai Stevenson or somebody write stirring essays on the national purpose. And everybody agreed that, yes, especially because of the Cold War with Russia and everything else, the Americans were fairly well united, and there wasn't any real controversy over that sort of thing, and that there wasn't much dissent, there wasn't much debate over this. I think that really has disappeared. Let me read James Reston, who some of you know from the New York Times, spotted this trend of a decline in national consensus as early as 1975. And I'll read here from his column from the Tribune. Well, it is from the New York Times, reprinted in the Minneapolis Tribune. "For there is apparently no generally accepted public philosophy, no common conviction of what is right or wrong or fair, and no definition by the national leaders of either party, or even by the leaders of the church, the universities, or the press, the big institutions, that will clarify the problem, override the factional interest, and unite the nation. This is not, of course, a new problem. It has tormented thoughtful men and women for ages. For it involves the fundamental question of whether civilized people can accept the disciplines essential to the effective operation of a free society and can agree on the compromises necessary for a sensible community and national life. He's got another long quotation here from Walter Lippmann, which I'll leave, but it sort of fills out what this sort of idea really is all about. So what I'm trying to suggest here, you see, is that we no longer think in terms of being Americans and having a national purpose is concerned, but we've been so fragmented because of various pressures, which I want to talk about, that we distrust those who keep talking about the fact that it is necessary to have this kind of purpose. Let me give you a very good example. That's something that Carter mentioned in one of his press conferences about the inflation thing, and obviously inflation is, you know, probably the most critical issue facing the country domestically right now. And Carter, you know, made the point, who of all the different pressure groups, agriculture, labor, management, all the rest, who's going to be the first one to say, we won't accept or we won't demand, you know, a price raise? Even the NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, came out and said, we aren't going to draw the line at our $500,000 a year salaries because we're entitled to them. As well as George Meany saying that he went in one day and was told that he was going to get a pro-labor bill from Carter, which would modify Taft-Hartley, and that sounded good. And the next day, Meany came out and said that we're not going to back off from our demands for a 10% raise, you know, for wages each year for the next few years. We're this. In other words, nobody in this country is willing to make the first sacrifice or take the first step in doing this sort of thing. And as a result, what's happening, and I'll be glad to discuss this in a little different connection a little bit later, is that people can come along like Jarvis, you see, in California and can capitalize on this and can come up with, well, I won't editorialize and give my opinion on it, but can come up with solutions like Proposition 13 with this, which makes the government in Washington look all the more worse because it's such an easy panacea that people believe that this one thing will, you know, take care of all these problems, and once we've taken care of that problem, we'll get back to the good old days. Only they forget that the good old days really weren't so good after all. All right, that's I think a third point: the lack of consensus that we have that's making a difference, that's causing much of the difficulty in the country, and that's showing up in the White House here. Two more that I want to talk about specifically dealing with American politics, and one that started really with Kennedy and was developed highly by Johnson, sort of a holding action, then reached its peak with Nixon, and then had sort of a holding action with Ford because he didn't have an elected mandate because he was appointed and so on, and then and has caused a great deal of difficulty so far as President Carter is concerned. And it first appeared in sort of formal form in a very important book in 1973 by a distinguished American historian, Arthur Schlesinger, entitled The Imperial Presidency. And I think the title almost gives away the thesis of what the book is all about. The Imperial Presidency, written by Schlesinger, who was at Harvard for a long time and then went to write speeches for Adlai Stevenson, and now he's teaching at CUNY and writes various important... He's got a new biography of Bobby Kennedy coming out this summer and so on. But anyway, Schlesinger noted something very, very important so far as the change in the power of the presidency itself was concerned in the 1960s and in the 1970s, and it has to do especially with the relationship of the United States to the Soviet Union so far as prestige and power in the whole world is concerned. What happened, you remember, in 1961, and this is what's happening now too with Sharansky very clearly with the Russians, is that the Russians decided to test this young, good-looking senator to see how tough he was, and to see if he was just, you know, one more sort of glamour candidate, or if he really was as tough as, say, John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower had been in the 1950s. So they started the stunts that led to the missile crisis, you remember, with Cuba, to find out if Kennedy was tough, okay? And Kennedy decided that he was tough, and that the only way to maintain the famous word that they used, and we still have it with us today, is credibility, is to appear to be in complete control of the situation at all times, to appear to be strong and aggressive and not back down, and to, as I suggested, be in command. All right. Then Kennedy never had the chance to really develop this idea of a very strong, dynamic president because of Dallas in November of 1973. And Johnson picked it up and developed it to a much higher degree than. Well, we don't know what Kennedy would have done with it because he never had the chance. But Johnson developed the idea of the imperial presidency, or the school of thought that led to the imperial presidency, much further with this. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that he took the office and deliberately made it to be what I would call the lightning rod, or the center of action for the country itself. He chose to make the Oval Office the most important position or the most important place in the government, instead of Wall Street or any other symbol of real power in this country. He took the leadership and said that the president is really responsible for how the country goes. And if it's a gamble. If you win, you're reelected, and you'll go down and you'll probably get your face on Mount Rushmore. And if you lose, you go back and write your memoirs in San Clemente. It was a real gamble that Johnson took. But Johnson, you see, had been in Washington since the Depression days. He was an AA, an assistant, administrative assistant for Sam Rayburn, and had worked his way up, and nobody knew how to handle the Senate better than, LBJ. With arm twisting and dealing, wheeling and dealing. And there's a very good book, if you like, reasonably light, but yet still sort of rewarding summer reading. Doris Kearns has written, it's in paperback, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. It's a marvelous book that I would highly recommend, and says much about Johnson that's worth knowing about. But anyway, what I'm trying to suggest, you see, is that Johnson knew he had the power, and he knew how to operate and pull the strings in Washington from all his years in the Senate, because he was probably the most effective Senate majority leader the country has seen since the days of Henry Clay, when you go way back into the 1830s. I have to break in here and tell one favorite story, because one of my teachers in graduate school said, when you lecture, he said, always halfway through, tell a humorous story, and that'll keep them, that'll relax them a little while, and then go back to the serious stuff again. So it's not quite half. But this actually happened in 1955. You remember he had a heart attack and went to Mayo, and my father had a heart attack at the same time. And one day my father was sitting in his underwear waiting for some tests, and he was reading the morning paper and didn't pay much attention to the fellow next to him. And the man said, "May I see the paper when you're done?" And it turned out to be Senator Lyndon Baines Johnson sitting next to him. And my father shared the paper with him, and then they started talking for a while. And my father's classic remark, he comes from a very small Norwegian Lutheran town, and you can imagine, Democrats are, well, they're about as populous as Egyptians in there. And my father's famous remark was, "Awfully nice fellow, even if he was a Democrat." But Johnson knew how to do it. And the trouble, of course, with Johnson was that he thought he could, get the great domestic reforms such as the Civil Rights Bill, Medicare, federal aid to education, and all of these things through, and win in Vietnam at the same time. Thought he could do it because he thought he had enough power in the imperial presidency to do it, because he knew how to twist arms and make deals. You read Kern's book, and she shows he knew every little petty detail, every little squabble, every little personality clash in Washington, and thrived on this. And you remember his bedtime reading was the reports that the FBI would have on, quote, enemies and critics of the government, in which they were spying on people like Dr. Martin Luther King, you remember, and all the rest. And Johnson wanted to know everything, and he was capable enough to be able to keep all these things, and balance them all the way through. All right. So Johnson really, more than Kennedy, created the office of the imperial presidency. If he couldn't get things done legally sometimes, as we'll see also when I mention Nixon, he would do things sometimes illegally. And it's interesting to notice that that came to mind because Bobby Baker, is a name from the past, is just out of jail. And like other people recently, he's was able to make a lot of money in jail by writing his memoirs. And that's gotten to be one way for an author to find time to get books written is go to jail. I suggest, you know, Magruder, Haldeman, you know, Ehrlichman, and one I have to say in an entirely different sense, and I don't mean to correlate them in the least, but some of you remember the ALC official Paul Bowe, and when he refused to testify in the Wounded Knee trial, he was sentenced, you remember, by the judge to a year in jail, and finally was released, not released, but was exonerated on a technicality. And I remember hearing Paul say that in a way he was disappointed because he had gotten all his reading, he was going to miss his family and miss his job and everything, but he had gotten all his reading and writing together and he was going to have a whole year free, you know, to write. Being a bureaucrat up at 426 South Fifth Street does take your time. That's the ALC headquarters and sort of the Minneapolis Vatican. Maybe that's one way to get books done instead of, you know, I don't know if I'm ready to do it because it took 4 years before I got the last book written. Maybe I should have gotten to jail and got... Well, I don't want to labor a good joke. All right. We're with us. All right. So LBJ created this idea of credibility and strength, you see, and power to let the Russians know that we were just as tough as they were. And we weren't going to back down in Vietnam because we had made a commitment there, and to back down would make us, you know, look weak, not only to the eyes of the Russians, but in the eyes of the Third World and all the rest. And Nixon picked this up, and Nixon went further with this because he came up with the idea that the United States, of course, had never lost a war, and he wasn't going to, remember, he said he wasn't going to be the first president ever to be in the White House when America did lose the war. And therefore, he was willing to go as far as he did with dirty tricks and Donald Segretti, there's a name that might spoil your day for you, and others, you know, in order to stay in office with this. But he used the powers of the presidency, you see, to maintain this posture of strength and power, even though it meant using some of the things that came out in the trials at the time. And the result of this is something which was summarized very well in an editorial that I want to read, or an essay, from the May 15th, 1978 issue of Time magazine by Henry Grunewald with this. And he's talking about the criticism of Carter. And you remember, for a while, journalists didn't seem to know what else to do except criticize Carter. For it was about March and April and into May for a while. And Grunewald, you know, said that much of it was deserved, but he made this point, which really sort of sums up this fourth point about the imperial presidency that I want to make here. The president is not only criticized for advancing this or that program, he is also criticized for not being able to engineer consent. Fair enough, up to a point, but if carried too far, such reasoning becomes circular and self-destructive. It exempts both the people and their representatives from the responsibility of using their minds, indeed from the responsibility of collaborating in the democratic process. And here it comes. It means the elevation or lowering of the presidency to a kind of magical dictatorship, where everything is a president's responsibility. This is often accompanied by a terrible kind of impatience, almost a sort of hysteria, where every problem, every mistake, or every seeming mistake becomes a self-reinforcing pattern of disaster. See what I'm trying to suggest with this sort of thing? The president, starting with Kennedy, they set off to make the presidency the problem-solving agency in the government, and so long as it worked like it did through the mid-60s with Johnson, fine, but then when it doesn't work, you know, it becomes the defeating part of it becomes self-reinforcing, and every mistake now that Ford made, you remember his mistake about Poland and in the debate with Carter and so on, and Carter's mistakes become self-reinforcing, and now the word is out, obviously, that Jimmy's in over his head. And every mistake that he makes now reinforces that, even though he may or may not be in over his head. But once the idea gets started in American public opinion, it's extremely difficult to get over this. All right, now I think a fifth trend that really, in a sense, ties many of these together came out in a very important and a very interesting piece, and we have it in the library here in May, I think it was, right, May 1978 by Kevin Phillips. It's called The Balkanization of America, and I'll explain what that means, The Balkanization of America. And I want to read this because it's so rare that I agree with Kevin Phillips it's worth mentioning. He was the one who predicted, for instance, a landslide for Goldwater in 1964, which makes you wonder, you know, a little bit about his powers of erudition. He kept saying, you know, the conservatives had been sitting on their hands and not voting for, you know, all those years. and so on and so forth. But he's written, I think, a very profound analysis, and he calls it the Balkanization of America. And by Balkanization, he refers to the idea that was so prevalent in between World War I and World War II of all the small little Balkan countries arguing and squabbling among themselves rather than cooperating. Balkanization simply means fragmentation, where you have many different countries so proud and determined, proud of their own traditions, and determined to hold on to these, that they lose sight of the larger issues that are at stake and the greater good that can be served by simply protecting their own interests. And you find this, Romania, you know, you're going to go through them, Yugoslavia, and even within Yugoslavia, the Serbs and the Croatians are still arguing. We've got a Croatian, you know, governor in Minnesota, and he doesn't call himself even Yugoslavian. That's too big a thing. He's a Croatian, as an example of how these things sort of so on. But that's what he means by Balkanization, with this sort of thing. All right, now, what's happening here, you see, is that the country itself has become Balkanized, really, into very strong, determined, militant, special interest groups. We've lost the consensus, and rather than having any kind of determined effort on the part of all the different special interest groups to find some common meeting ground, what we have simply is really virtually open warfare among these many different groups. And this is showing up in politics, which I want to talk about briefly, and it's showing up some other ways which I want to read directly from Phillips. So let me give you just a couple of examples of what I'm getting at today. Today we identify ourselves primarily with special interest groups rather than with the larger interest of being members of a region or members of a country. We belong, for instance, to let's say the farm bloc, and the farmers member drove their big tractors into Washington, or we are totally committed either pro or con to abortion, and that has become an enormously emotional issue. And I suppose if anything has divided the American people more in the nothing, I'll put it the other way, nothing has divided the American people, I think, in the 1970s more than the issue of abortion, because there's no compromise. You can compromise on farm bills, and you can compromise on a lot of other things, but you can't compromise on abortion, and it's getting into violence. I live near Highland Park, where there's a Planned Parenthood clinic, and I don't know how many times, you know, it's been fired and harassed and all the rest of the things that go along with this sort of thing. Or the whole thing with Anita Bryant, the fragmentation or balkanization of the gay movement, the taxpayer thing. Howard Jarvis is a good example. The environmentalist people who won the big battle, remember, with the dam down in Tennessee, is a major example of this. Or the veterans groups would be another example. The unions, the natural gas lobby, which is, for instance, is very strong. Or just take one thing, which I'm sure for some of those older ones is very strong. Think how strong the high school teacher unions have become in recent years. If any of you know Minnesota, maybe you'd be surprised to know that the second longest high school teacher strike in American history happened in Faribault, Minnesota, which is not exactly, you know, a hotbed of radical liberal politics. It's the peony capital of America. That's what you remember. That's what you remember Faribault for, and quite rightly so. They've got some beautiful, you know, peonies there, and Andrews. But the teachers were, you know, people that I've taught. They're probably sons and daughters, maybe some of you. The teachers' unions have become enormously strong, and one reason the Democrats keep winning in Minnesota is that they've got the teachers' union tightly organized, and they're keeping them there. But the point is that instead, you know, the battles that are going on between school boards and school and teachers right now, instead of talking about what is in the best interest of the students, they're talking about what is in the best interest of the taxpayers or what is in the best interest of the teachers themselves. So I happen to be a teacher, and that gives away my bias, I have no I just say that straight up. But that particular balkanization or fragmentation started happening, you see, in a little bit earlier. Let me read again from Reston, who saw this so clearly in 1975. It isn't just something that's happened in the last year or two. And the truth is plain for everybody to see. There is a rise of factionalism in America, something beyond the old battles between management and labor, but a feeling even among teachers, firemen, firefighters. We've just seen this in Memphis and Philadelphia, for instance, and so on, when police go out on strike and all the rest. I remember in San Francisco when the nurses went on strike, angels of mercy, out on the picket line, and it just didn't make any sense until I began to realize something about what kind of economic conditions were facing them, and I could see their situation. But you'd never dreamed this would happen. Nurses were supposed to be, as I say, angels. But a feeling even among teachers, policemen, firefighters, and other public servants that they can protect their own interest only by fighting the public they are supposed to serve. In other words, instead of cooperation, it's become competition. It's become conflict all the way through with this. So let me read another example here of, I've got time, from Phillips' article here. He calls this biological fragmentation, overcoming the United States. He finds five biological denominators currently lend themselves to civil rights campaigns and the assertion of group identities: sex, sexual preference, age, race, and ethnic origin. And rising egocentrism is a related development. Okay. Fragmentation of American society by sex and sexual preference groups need not be greatly elaborated here, given the extent to which it has been dwelt on everywhere. We all know about what happened in Miami and what happened in St. Paul and in Wichita, for instance, and so on. Escalating definitions of rights produce at least two unfortunate results: group categorization and militants. Feminism has gone far beyond Susan B. Anthony. Certainly the organization, cohesion, and civil rights militance of homosexuals is a new phenomenon in American society. Gay power has as much political weight in San Francisco as does the Steel Caucus in a certain valley that he mentions here in Ohio. Age is yet another denominator. The group awareness of senior citizens. Gay power is a considerable phenomenon in Florida, Arizona, and California. And I only suggest, for instance, recently Congress passed the law raising the mandatory requirement age for requirement from 65 to 70. Gay power was organized in Washington. At the other end of the age chart, more and more legal rights are being defined for children. Even second and third trimester fetuses have had their own biological Balkan army marshaled for them in the Right to Life movement. He's got more examples that I could mention here with this. All right, but I think you see what I'm trying to suggest. All right, now, what does all this have to do with President Carter? What Carter is trying to do, you see, is to avoid being the imperial president. He came in as a non-establishment person who was not tainted by having lived in Washington and been associated with what was going on at that particular point, and had tried at the beginning to propose various programs which hadn't been talked about very much before, and tried to present these over the head of Congress directly to the American public. And as a result of this, he bypassed Congress and finds that his chief obstacle in Washington right now, obviously, is Congress itself. The energy bill, 15 months, has been stalled and shows no signs really of changing or being improved in any particular way. And yet, because of the fact that he isn't an imperial president type with the arm twister and knowing Congress like LBJ was, or using the kinds of threats, for instance, that Nixon used, for instance, if there was a criticism somewhere of a Nixon administration, pretty soon somebody would come up with an IRS audit. Even Billy Graham, for instance, was told once when he had something that was mildly anti-Nixon that he was going to be audited. That's a pretty powerful threat. Even John Wayne, for goodness sake, was reminded that even he might be audited at some time. Just read Colson's Born Again, and Colson talks about it himself freely. And I still have some. I know the Lord can do wonderful things. And Colson was the Boy, he had a long ways to go with Coulson, and I really think he's achieved it. I really do. But you see what I'm trying to suggest here is the lack of consensus, the lack of trust, the feeling that we have a weak president, but the alternative would be to go back to an imperial kind of president, and I'm sure very few of us in this country would want that kind of president back in office again with us. And you know, if you diagnose a problem, usually you should come up with some sort of solution, and the time is nearing, and I'm sure some of you have your stomachs telling you that it's coffee time. So I want to read what I consider to be, in general terms, a way out of this kind of dilemma that we're in at the time, the fact that we've got fragmentation and suspicion of government and lack of confidence in our basic institutions and seemingly no particular direction to go. Oh, I might add, too, that one more thing with Carter, he's being tested by the Russians the same way Kennedy was being tested with the Sharansky thing. Because right now what's happening in the Kremlin is obviously there's a power struggle going on, because Brezhnev is just being held alive by a pacemaker and some other drugs and a couple of other things, and obviously it's a game of what they call in politics chicken, to see who isn't the chicken, to see how tough you are, and to prove how tough you are, you have to be tough, you know, with your adversary, and your adversary is the United States at this time, and this is why they went through with something as outrageous, you see, as Sharansky, to test Carter to see how tough he was. It could have been Nixon, it could have been Ford, I'm sure they would have done the same thing with Ford. It isn't the matter of it being a Republican or a Democrat. And therefore, since Carter has made his commitment on human rights, since he also believes very strongly in the SALT, or the Strategic Arms Limitations talks and all the rest, he appears to be waffling. But while the real problem is, I think, not so much the fact that Carter is trying to do two or three things at the same time, the real problem is what the Russians are trying to do, you know, to the United States. I mean, when you say that you know, a president isn't leading well, it's a two-way street, because politics is, you know, as I say, is a two-way thing in which there has to be cooperation, you know, both ways with us. And hence, when there is only the president speaking for the national interest, whereas you've got Congress being dominated by the interest lobby. The best example would be the natural gas lobby, you know, of enormous influence, and they're the ones who've bottled up the energy bill more than, you know, than anybody else. Then we have the kind of dilemma that we're in. But I think, you know, I'd like to close with a diagnosis here and a solution that Daniel Bell, who used to write for Fortune and now teaches at Columbia, made, that I think is one way to try to put into perspective what might be done. This is a rather long quote, but I'll go through it. There were and are two special requirements for equity or justice in a representative republic. First, that all interests must be represented, all the different factions, all the different balkanization units must be represented. And second, that all issues must be viewed as negotiable. And this is that there are solutions, because if you start to believe that there aren't solutions, you know, you're in real trouble. All right. The mechanisms of compromise still exist. That is, he's saying that there are solutions to these problems still available. The question today is whether there will be a will to use them. Here, too, there is a prior condition for their use, the need for some transcendent tie to bind individuals sufficiently for them to make the occasional necessary sacrifices of self-interest. I'll read that again. The need for some transcendent tie to bind individuals sufficiently for them to make the occasional necessary sacrifice of self-interest. Because what we're living in, and I'll be talking about this later too, is what, you know, Tom Wolfe has called the me decade, or looking out for number one, how to get power. I have a little very unscientific sampling I make at the B. Dalton bookstore in Minneapolis. And 5 years ago, they had one shelf of self-help books on looking after number one and all these things. Now there are 5.5 shelves of the self-help kinds of books. And I took Looking Out for Number One with me on the train, and got so, it wasn't the rail bed on Amtrak that got me nauseated, although it contributed. But anyway, I was reading the Ringer thing, really pretty bad. All right. Anyway, historically, what has united a people has been a ruler, a doctrine, or a destiny. Sometimes in the great periods of a people, a fusion of the three, a ruler, a doctrine, or a destiny. In the United States, what gave purpose to the Republic at its founding was a sense of destiny. Remember Jefferson of the Declaration of Independence, or Abraham Lincoln, the last hope of earth. If democracy failed here, it would fail, you know, everywhere around the world. A sense of destiny. The idea expressed by Jefferson that on this virgin continent, God's design would be unfolded. On a virgin continent, men could be free to pursue their individual ends and celebrate their achievements. The doctrine was shaped by a Protestantism that emphasized sobriety and work, the good old Puritan ethic, which resisted the temptations of the flesh, you know, self-denial of self-gratification and for future reward, which emphasized sobriety and work. By and large, the belief in the great man was more muted in the United States than in other societies. Now, over the years, this quiet sense of destiny and harsh creed of personal conduct were often replaced by a virulent Americanism, a manifest destiny that took us overseas, and a materialistic hedonism that provided the incentives to work. Today, that manifest destiny is shattered, the idea that America should, you know, dominate the world, and I only have to refer you to the Panama Canal debate over that. That Americanism has worn thin, and only the hedonism remains. It is a poor recipe for national unity and purpose. Is what he's trying to say, is that we've become a very selfish people. What he calls national hedonism. And this is a very poor recipe for national unity and national purpose. Yet, in this time of trial and defeat, and as I've tried to suggest, we're in a very difficult period right now, it is possible to see the outlines of a new purpose, one based on a self-conscious maturity that dispenses with ideologies, dispenses with image or PR concerned leaders, and manifest destiny, and seeks to redefine the self and the good society on the only basis on which they can survive. And here's the point. The redefinition would be based on a recognition of the limits of our power, individual and social, to deal with unlimited appetites and wants. Now that's a big phrase and I'll repeat it, but I think it's the key to everything I've been saying here and why I think we're in trouble. And why the president is in trouble. The redefinition would be based on a recognition of the limits of our power, individual and social, to deal with unlimited appetites and wants. Any such purpose would be the basis of a new social compact, but of a compact that does not ignore the past. It was the pride of classical liberalism and of social utopianism as well that in each new generation men could start afresh and discard the past. It is true that within limits men can remake themselves in society, but the knowledge of power must coexist with the knowledge of its limits. This is, after all, the oldest and the most enduring truth about the human condition, if it is to remain human. And, you know, one last metaphor that I would like to use here, and I think since Billy Martin is in the news now, that's what's happening since the imperial presidency and the fragmentation and all the rest, is that like in baseball, you hire managers to fire them, because when the team gets in trouble, what do? You don't fire Rod Carew, or since I'm a loyal Twin fan or all the rest, but what's happening here is, well, when you get in trouble, you fire the leader. And what was it, the Angels were 1.5 games out of first place and they fired the manager? And what I'm trying to suggest in this country is a recognition that perhaps the leaders aren't necessarily always the ones who are to blame for this, but was it that famous statement from Walt Kelly and Pogo that we have met the enemy, you know, and he is us. And without that kind of, we can't blame it on communists anymore. You remember in the 1960s or the 1950s, we can't blame it on Parlor Pinks anymore. And really, in spite of Howard Jarvis, we can't blame it on, you know, big spending, you know, bureaucrats in Washington, because I would really like to see exactly what they would like to cut out, the schools, you know, the fire, the police, and all the rest of these things. But we really have to blame it on ourselves. And what we have asked our president to do is to become something of a magician. And as it turns out, the one we have in the White House is not a magician, and he's not a magician because everybody's looking out really for themselves rather than working for a kind of good in which we would put limitations on our powers. And that's very difficult, of course, for Americans to do because of the enormous power which we have exercised throughout the world. So I would simply like to throw it open for questions and comments. If some of you want to leave for coffee, fine. If some of you want to stay, Fine. Yeah.
In trying to push that a little further, in your, I'm curious to your comments about whether Carter senses that, and in his public rhetoric, I don't, you know, I hear him wrestling with that kind of concept, but unsure how to do the leading, setting the tone for a national.
I'm thinking of Kennedy's inauguration. Because he has to balance all these different factions. And what I'm wondering, I have to use Minnesota politics, and we're factionalized now. We've got the environmentalists, we've got abortion people, we've got farmers, we've got a power line controversy. They're taking some big power lines right over farmers' lands, which I think is wrong. And, you know, what really might happen in this country is we might split into many different political parties. And that really scares me, because we could wind up with something like Italy, for instance, where you have 7 or 8 parties, or France, rather than the two-party system. And what the president has to do is be a juggler and keep all these things in office.
Doesn't he need to address that by talking more about national, not manifest destiny, but what you just stated here is setting
recognition of the limits. Yeah, the limits of power, right on this. And I think with his energy bill, this is what he's trying to do, because he's trying to say that we are going to run out of petroleum and that we might have to have gas rationing, and that scares me, because I have to drive 35 miles one way to work. I don't want gas rationing. And by the way, if you're interested, the mafia, they might not even go through government. This is more than just a joke. The mafia is all ready for the black market in gas rationing, and what they might do, since they're so well organized, is just give gas rationing administration over to the mafia and let them take care of it, because they've got the black market all ready for it.
It seems to me that the Panama Canal debates and outcome have presaged some of this that he's writing about, in a recognition of the fact that we are not the owners of of the world, and that the Panama Canal zone is not United States.
Right. Well, we stole, you remember what Senator Hayakawa said, we stole it fair and square.
Right. The test being, of course, the children born in the canal zone are Panamanian citizens.
Yeah, right.
And if it was United States, they would be United States citizens.
Yeah, that's another faction, you know. Where, remember, they were going to get the American Conservative Union was going to get up, you know, millions of dollars, Representative Crane from Illinois and all the rest, and we're going to defeat everybody who voted for the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're going to vote everybody who voted for abortion or for Boundary Waters Canoe. That's the big environmental issue in Minnesota or everything else. You're not going to have anybody to vote for, because nobody can put together this kind of package any longer.
It's really, it seems to me, if somehow the lack of popularity of Carter cannot also be traced to maybe some really the basic feelings of our country. I think Carter has more than anyone in a long time aligned himself with minorities.
Yes.
Been willing to have a new policy in Africa, which I don't think really many people are willing to to really go along with what he has said was our, you know, the whole idea of human rights is great, except when it begins to interfere with Russia and things of this nature, you know.
And he raised their expectations, and if you have the chance, the book that was recommended for the year, Lighting Our Darkness, talks about expectations and achievements. And Carter raised the expectations of many minorities, the blacks, for instance, and what was it, 94% of the total black population went for Carter, and the Indians, and now if you follow, you know, like what Mr. Hook said from the NAACP, and now the Indians are in Washington marching, they feel betrayed by Carter because their expectations were so high. And two more factions, you see, pressure groups who are saying they're going to abandon him. And my only question would be, you know, where would they go?
You've got to raise expectations to be elected.
Yeah.
And then you run up against the solid brick wall of...
Yeah, and there we have just, I think, a real flaw in democracy. Because to be elected, you have to be critical of the incumbents, of the people in office. And that creates distrust. And the only way you can get into office is to convince the voter that you can do a better job. And the press thrives on, you remember Les's talk the other night about the press only has bad news. The press thrives on these things. And therefore, what we get, no matter who it is, Ford in office, or whoever it is in office, all we get is the bad news. And therefore, we tend to think that everything that goes on is wrong. You start right off with the bad news. I remember one night the family was watching, and it was Walter Cronkite in the first 20 minutes, and it was all just grief, and in 20 minutes we were all crying, you know, really, because it was just, you know, piled up one after another. And in a democracy, you have to create distrust, and it's very difficult to be able to overcome that. And Carter oversold, no question, he oversold what he could do, and wasn't familiar with what the limitations of power in Washington are. And now the backlash is setting in, and the backlash is setting in the form of these, you know, various, you know, special interest groups that I've talked about, and he doesn't know how to cope with it. And I don't know if anybody, you know, knows how to cope with it. And it might be what you and I, Mr. We were talking about. It might take a national disaster, as much as I hate to say it, a recession, or running out of oil, or the Arabs turning off the tap again. How many people from Minnesota could get out here if they turned out the tap? Remember the Colorado gas stations where you couldn't get gas except on 2 days a week or something? That it might take something like that to do it, and that would be a terrible thing. But I wanted to ask questions and not give them more of a speech. Yeah, Nick?
Just the week before we started out here, I certainly heard a person that would certainly be a new force against what you're talking about. His name is Zumwalt, the Admiral.
Oh, Admiral Zumwalt, yeah.
He is in Wisconsin now and has taken up residence there, and he's there, I think, for two main purposes, to defeat Aspen and to defeat Proxmire.
Yeah, well, I would go along with the second, but that's all right.
Of course, the first thing that he says in his speeches is that we need a strong ruler and we need the destiny. And of course, the destiny is that the United States is still the supreme power in the world. And this guy is serious, and he's really got a lot of following. And I see that as a new political force that's coming. And I think Zumwalt and a whole group of military people,
yeah,
are going to have to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And the time is ripe, as you have said, for,
yeah,
a very strong military president to come around again.
Could well be.
That's my feeling.
It could well be that a man on a white horse might be what the people will buy, because Carter comes along deliberately low-key, carrying his own bags on the plane, the whole informal thing, jeans at a press conference instead of the imperial presidency. Remember, Nixon even had royal blue behind him at press conferences to enhance the image. Mort Sahl has the best joke of all. Nixon was born in a blue suit. and it could well be because the Panama Canal Treaty touched off something there that's
building a political base,
yeah,
in Wisconsin. I think you shouldn't have to be reckless.
The antidote there, I think, would be young people in the 20s and the 30s who went through and were so turned off by the escapade in Vietnam that they wouldn't accept us. How strong a faction that would be as an organized political force is something else again.
Many of them are turned off even from voting.
From voting, yeah.
And you can't have real political power in this country without at least registering their vote,
yeah,
and coming out to the polls and expressing it in that way, which is the final determinant as,
yeah,
to who gets in and who doesn't.
Yeah,
I piggybacks on the whole tax thing.
Yes.
He's just got the whole thing that you've been talking about. He's got those five things down very well.
Yeah.
And he's got an antidote or a solution to each one of them.
Yeah. And it's television zooms in on this and does it so brilliantly because it's dramatic. There's conflict. There's excitement. With all due respect, when Stokely Carmichael first got on television, he had a following of 30 people, but he got 3 minutes on Walter Cronkite because it was conflict. And we had it in Minneapolis when we were having some riots, and they waited around until the television cameras came before they started throwing stones. Some people know how to do that very, very well. Yeah, it's kind of.
I'd like to make a comment, if I could, about Proposition 13 being in California.
Sure.
And I think a good example of what can be sold to people was Proposition 13.
I don't want to pay. I pay more in, not where I live now, but before, I paid more in real estate taxes then, just as I sold that house, than I almost did when I first started working, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And
I have no no argument about the fact that the taxes are high, and perhaps they should be equalized in some way. But 13 was using a buzzsaw to do a delicate operation.
Where Carter made the mistake, remember, he said that you can't solve unemployment and inflation at the same time, and he concentrated on unemployment, and he has reduced unemployment, but inflation, on the other hand, has gotten out of hand, and that's the big issue now, and whoever can come up with the best program to stop, and I'll vote for him, because I paid 99 cents for a head of celery the other day. I couldn't believe it. I just, 99 cents for a head of lettuce is,
In California, in the right where lettuce is being grown, because of the flooding, lettuce went to $1 a head, and no one bought it, and it was down in 3 days.
Good.
It came right down.
And there's another, you know, special faction that all of these are necessary, the factions. I'm not saying the consumer faction is necessary, and putting pressure on.
Why is it that everybody screams about $1 for a head of lettuce to pay $8,000 for an automobile without the screaming? I don't understand.
Sure.
Like 30 cents more for a head of lettuce.
Yeah, because...
But we're paying 4 years for a vehicle we used to pay for three.
But I've got a two-hour lecture on the American automobile that I won't deliver.
The
difference is that we can do something about the lettuce, and we don't feel we can do anything about the cars. This is what it
means. Buy used cars.
No, but you don't, because the American dream. And I taught a course in American popular culture, and nowhere in the world does the automobile have more meaning. And of all kinds, economic, sexual, social, political, every kind of meaning than in America with the automobile.
And they're closing Amtrak down on us too.
So what it says to me is that our values are all screwed up, and we are willing to continue in our selfish quest for all of the material things and not look at what the real values are.
I had to leave out half of what I had, and there's an ad in the Minneapolis television, buy your big Mercury now, because next year, folks, the Mercury is going to be smaller. And he said it straight out. I mean, pure selfishness.
Was there a big change between, I was brought up, my history is bad, but that the presidencies were very strong in the war years and Truman.
Yeah, but
what's the difference? I don't quite see the difference in the imperial presidency, that concept.
Because both LBJ and Nixon became paranoid over dissent to their administrations and were willing to use illegal means to stop the dissent. We know that LBJ did. If you've read, I don't believe much of Lasky's book, it didn't start with Watergate, but there's enough truth in there to give it some credibility, and we know what happened with Dirty Tricks and Segretti.
So it was more misuse of
misuse of power, and the use of the FBI that's just now beginning to come out, because
back to Kennedy and before.
Yeah, right. Kennedy used
FDR.
But that would be the basic difference, I think, more than anything else. And what they call the bunker mentality in the White House, and apparently Carter's getting that now too. That you get in a bunker and the whole world is against you, and they're lobbing in shells, and you've got to protect yourself against this. And LBJ had this. This is probably why he quit in '68. And Nixon had the, if you read Sapphire's book, Nixon had the bunker mentality, and now Carter's beginning to feel it. And it was so bad with Johnson, you remember, that Johnson wanted to give a speech, and the only place he dared give a speech was at a military establishment. Otherwise, the students or the dissenters, would get him. Or Nixon had the same one. He finally gave it out at General Beadle Teachers College in South Dakota. That was fairly safe.
Can we avoid the, I hate the charger and the man and the white horse coming over. I think the strong presidency, if we get to a military presidency, we may lose the whole
army. Oh, yeah, it could well happen. And there's a danger there. The danger there is coming up with this talk about having a new constitutional convention.
Oh.
Because if we do that, we can vote out the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And 22 states have already approved a constitutional convention where we can all get together. It's mainly an abortion thing, is where it got the impetus. And I have, don't ask me on the abortion thing, because I have no wisdom whatsoever. But that's how it got started. But that's where it could happen.
Part of the Constitution.
And I don't know. That one really frightens me. and you know, they usually take these tests, they did it at the University of Minnesota. They'll take the Bill of Rights downtown Minneapolis and ask people to sign it. And they, people, what was it, many, at the University of Minnesota, 72%, 72% wouldn't sign it because it was too radical. And this was the Bill of Rights.
Just 10 amendments to the Constitution.
Yeah. And you get scared when you hear things like that. Yeah, in the back.
Assuming that inflation is going to bring us to this brink of this national disaster, what role do you think will wage and price controls have to? I think they're going to have to be implemented.
Okay.
Somehow.
Yeah. People say I don't want to defend Carter here on this point, but people say Carter's weak, but the alternative would be wage and price controls, and if I took a vote of hands now, 1%, maybe not even that, of the people here would want wage and price controls right now. But, they don't want inflation, but they don't want, the antidote, which is wage and price controls.
Hmm? We all want everybody else to pull them down.
Yeah, yeah.
And is anybody working on this
Roberts,
new destiny that you mentioned at the end of your presentation?
There are think tanks. Right offhand, we haven't filled in the vacuum after Vietnam and Watergate. We haven't got a new sense of national purpose and where we might go. Americans right now, I think, are in a position where we know natural resources and all the rest are going to run out, and we're going to get our share of fun and enjoyment, the and jollies, before it's too late. With especially with natural resources, and the environmental thing, I think is coming on. That's why I say we're in a difficult kind of situation, and why, in a way, we've put ourselves in that because we've made the presidency into that kind of office, and we don't know what to do when the presidency lets us down. Nixon got the biggest majority. Of course, you can always argue, did Nixon win or did McGovern lose? It probably was the latter. Yeah, so if the presidency can't do it, we're really at this particular point lost. There was a glimmer of hope when Carter got out and walked down Massachusetts mm-hmm. Avenue on inauguration day, and that was a sign. But that sort of thing is.
The question as to the person who can draw these factions.
And you see, television has personalized politics so much. That we depend on personalities rather than on issues, so much more so, and they have to be a good family man, all the other things that have to go along with this, that's bad, rather than strictly in issues. And a good example of this would be Robert McNamara in the 1960s, as tough and as brilliant an administrator as we ever have, but a man who paid absolutely no attention to PR. As a result, he never got anywhere in politics. But a McNamara could have, done an enormously good job. But he couldn't play the baby kissing routine.
Seems to me that one possibility might be to shorten the time for electioneering.
Yes.
England. You don't have time in 6 weeks to do much but define and talk about issues. If you have 2 years, you get into the nitpicking and the personalities and the backgrounds and all the rest.
He's retired now, but Mike Mansfield, used to be the Senate Majority Leader from Montana, would get up after every election and make this speech, and everybody would say, "Amen, that's right, Mike." And nobody would do anything about it. That's as far as it went, right?
They go to the country over there, and the election is set 6 weeks away, and you talk about issues, and they vote, and that's it.
Yeah.
And here we fool around and spend $1,800 million on television ads, and it's stupid.
It's
dangerous.
And it gets to be corrupt, because then you get the things that led to, I'm trying to think of the Minneapolis grain dealers that were, got in with Nixon, and were the people who could, that Jack Chestnut, Humphrey's associate, I don't want to be bipartisan about this, who wanted to please his boss, just like Colson wanted to please his boss, and so he took illegal money without telling Humphrey that he did so. Mm-hmm. And so on, because the pressure to get money is that great, and then we could get into the whole Korean and the whole South Korean influence scandal thing is another example for this, because money has this enormous influence, and Al Kui, for instance, right now, who nobody accuses of being anything but the highest possible caliber, says he's running for governor in Minnesota, and he's been here and all the rest. he said he needs, you know, a certain amount of money, and it's just cut and dried in PR that unless he has a certain budget, he won't be elected.
Sure.
And isn't it in California you have a PR place thing called Robert something, where they guarantee that they can elect a man who's running for office and they haven't lost.
For X dollars.
Yeah, and for X dollars, right? They know they can do this sort of thing, and the stakes are too high to lose. And I think
sounds like science fiction, but
yeah,
it's happening.
Yeah.
They got a lot of trouble because they couldn't defeat Proposition 13.
They couldn't know. Yeah. They hired the firm. They lost on 13.
Yeah, they paid the money, but the firm couldn't deliver.
That's interesting. That must be the first time they've lost. Something Roberts.
13 was weird.
Yeah, believe it.
Really weird. I don't think so. I wanted to make a comment in the sense it seems to me very interesting that, you know, that you have a president who has stressed human rights and the Christian church to a great extent. I wonder how many people have ever commended him, you know, for that sort of thing, for doing some things that took some real guts and courage. Panama Canal, B-1 bomber.
Yeah, the neutron bomb.
Neutron bomb, you know, and you hear very little in the Christian church of support for that kind of stand.
Yeah.
You know, and the only thing we're concerned about, it seems like to me, is more the hit of lettuce. You know, that's where, at least, you know, the church where we're at. And it's very, to me, very disconcerting that one of the few presidents that I know of come out, you know, with some real human rights stands,
and the only thing
they can do is get nitpicking about why doesn't he do it all the time. A president can't do it all
you
the
see,
time.
This would bear out this idea that Schlesinger has, that you have to be tough on armaments and on defense, or I would call it offense spending, because otherwise you're weak, and therefore when Carter came out for a cut in, you know, defense spending, it was considered a sign of weakness rather than a first step towards disarmament. And I have to say that the organized Christian church didn't applaud him for the neutron bomb and for the other things along these lines.
It was even interesting that even the peace movement, at least the contact that I was in, was even unwilling to send him a letter of thank you.
Yeah.
It was, don't even consider that. Even the peace movement was not willing even to send him thank you for that stand. Now that's really interesting.
Well, one of the worst parts is that we mesmerize ourselves so much into believing that the president can do all these things if we just elect the right one. And he really, his powers are so limited if we don't push the Congress behind him. He can't do anything.
Really. What I was trying to suggest is that in large part, the presidency, starting with Kennedy, really has encouraged this idea that the president can do these things.
That's the danger.
That's the danger, right.
Charisma can be bad.
Yeah, and
of course these long campaigns, like you mentioned, just enhance this notion.
They do.
This man can do everything.
Yeah.
He really can.
Because of the fact that the media can create for someone an image.
Right. I think there's another program here. We just went through coffee break, folks. So this was good. Thanks. And if anybody wants
to... Thank you.